I think my dream is really like a detective story, or a puzzle, or an adventure, or an exploration, or like trying to make sense of a jigsaw puzzle. Do you have these jigsaw puzzles in China?
Yes.
Yes.
You do? Okay, so these are the bits of our confused world jigsaw. And what I'm trying to do for you in the lectures is gradually to see how they all fit together. So in the first four parts, which is two lectures, I've laid out the question, war, trade and empire, agriculture and industry, capitalism and money. So we have the beginnings of a picture, but there is much more. All these other bits have to be fitted in. So I'm going to take two more bits and try and fit them there. The question is, how did the modern world emerge? Modernity being defined as the separation between politics, ideology, economics and society. And part of the answer lies in war, trading and empire. Part of it lies in the first industrial revolution, which occurred in England long before, two generations before anywhere else. But the origins of our modern industrial world were in England. And then finally I looked at the origins of capitalism as a separation between the economic and the social worlds. And again, as Weber said, the origins of the capitalist world are in England. Here I want to look firstly at material wealth. That means physical things. That means things like clean water or a nice tweed, Paris tweed jacket or decent English shoes, British shoes. So I want to look at the material world, by which we often judge modernity. When I first came to China with my wife in 1996, we went to a little village north of Beijing. And there we met some peasants in a village. And we asked them what life was like. And they said, oh, it's much, much better. It's getting better every day. Look, we have a fridge. Look, we are eating meat. Look, we are eating good vegetables. Our children are going to school. Material wealth is beginning to come. And the great burst of Chinese civilization, of course, in the last 20 years has been a great expansion of material wealth. And so we often think of the modern world in terms of producing lots of good quality food and other goods. This is something very new. All civilizations, agrarian, agricultural civilizations, have had a few very rich people living in them who have good clothes and food. But usually, it's only 5% at the most, and the rest are struggling. And the bottom half, at least, or three quarters, are miserable. They don't have enough food, they have bad sanitation, they have awful houses, they have clothes, and they are in constant fear of hunger and disease. The modern world is the gradual elimination of that, part of the effects of the modern world. So how did that happen and when did it happen? Well, my argument here is that it happened for the first time over a long period of some hundreds of years in England. England has had the good fortune. It has a reasonable climate, a lot of rain, which you don't have in Beijing. It has good soil, it is an island, and for those reasons and many others, it has been a very rich place for the last 1,000 years. Almost everyone who came to England noted that this was the case, that England was very rich. For instance, in the middle of the 18th century, that's 200 years ago, a Frenchman wrote, comparing France and England, which people often did, "Our Frenchmen eat soup. They just have soup with a little butter sometimes and a few vegetables. They hardly ever can eat meat in France in the 18th century, ordinary Frenchmen. They sometimes drink a little cider, which is a drink made from apples, but usually they just drink water. They cannot even afford wine in France. In contrast," he said, "your English people, they eat meat, and a great deal of it. Almost every meal, they would have some meat. And they drink beer continually, in such a fashion that an Englishman spends three times more than a Frenchman." This is an 18th century French visitor. This is the 18th century, but it goes right back in history. If you go back, say, 250 years or so, to a Venetian visitor, the ambassador to England, who wrote around the year 1500, this is before the Reformation. The Venetian ambassador, of course, comes from, in many ways, the richest country or small state in Europe. Venice, at the end of the 15th century, is immensely rich. It's a great trading center, as you know. And yet, even he, coming from Venice, was enormously impressed by the wealth of the English. He says that he traveled around England, and he said that there was, I quote, "great fertility of the soil," something I mentioned. The soil was good, rich soil, which would grow grass and grain. Also, they had valuable tin, they had metals. And above all, from the extraordinary abundance of wool, they kept many sheep, and they exported the wool to France and elsewhere. "Whatever the reasons," he said, "everyone who makes a tour in this island will soon become aware of this great wealth." Now, if you go back another 200 years and look at an encyclopedia written by a friar, that is a religious leader, in his large encyclopedia of the middle of the 13th century, that's about 1250, he says, "England is a strong land and a sturdy and the plenteous corner of the world." That means that it has more things than any other part of the world as far as he knew. In his encyclopedia, he describes various countries. He says, "so rich a land that without compulsion, it does not need any help from any other land, and every other land needs help from England." He says, "it is full of mirth and of games, and men oftentimes have mirth and games." This picture of medieval England in the 12th, 13th century fits with other descriptions, which I won't give you now. But if you read, again, something I mentioned, the Canterbury Tales by Geoffrey Chaucer, the famous medieval 14th century poem of people going down on a pilgrimage, the picture of the eating, the drinking, the games, the humour, the clothing that you'll see in Chaucer is of a very rich country, not much different from what you would see in this room now in terms of food and clothing. While it was rich in this period, its wealth, as I'll explain, gradually grew and grew and grew, so that by the 17th century, that is the time of the English Civil War, it is with Holland, the Dutch, the wealthiest country in the world. Daniel Defoe, who wrote Robinson Crusoe, wrote in the early 18th century, "the working manufacturing people of England eat the fat, and drink the sweet. They live better and fare better than the working poor of any other nation in Europe. They make better wages for their work and spend more of the money upon their backs and bellies than in any other country. You can see this, and I won't go into it now, but if you look at the food, the calorie intake, the amount of meat, the amount of milk, cheese, butter that was consumed, and the vegetables, and the fact that the English population did not eat anything but the best grain. So they ate wheat, which is a very good grain. They didn't have to live on oats, which the Scottish population had to do, which is an inferior grain. But they drank a huge amount of high protein drink, i.e. beer. Almost everyone drank 2 pints of beer. Everyone in England in the 300 or 400 years, including small children, would drink 3 or 4 times this of beer. And beer has a lot of nutrition in it. As I think I mentioned before, half of the grain harvest in England was turned into beer. No other country could have done. And later, when they put taxes on the beer, they started to drink, of course, Chinese tea. So they drank well, they ate well, their clothing was, everyone said was wonderful. They had all these sheep, and so they made wonderful woolen clothing. And because they had the sheep and cows, they had very good leather. So all English people wore shoes, and good shoes. If you look at peasants in most countries, if you look at them in France, Italy, Scotland, let alone India, China, you'll see people running around in pictures or descriptions without shoes on. You can't afford shoes. But in England, you could afford shoes, and you had hats. The English love hats. I've left my hat at the back, unfortunately, but you may have seen me in it. We love hats, and my hat here is made out of leather. Their houses were very, very good. If any of you have a chance to go to England, you will find the countryside is filled, the villages are filled with really good houses, many of them going back 300, 400, 500 years. I live in a house which is 300 years old. That is not at all uncommon, because the houses have remained. Many big country houses, but also average people's houses, were really well built and warm and substantial. And finally, they had a lot of spare time. This is a very important index. For instance, in the discussion that's going on about whether China and Europe were different, many people say, well, in the, particularly as I mentioned before, in the Shanghai area, in the Yangtze Delta, they had a high standard of living in many ways. They didn't eat much meat, and the clothing was not as good, but they had a reasonable standard of living. But then when you ask, how did they do this? They did this by hard work. They worked incredibly hard. And the same is true of the Japanese. Rice cultivation, to produce surpluses from rice, you have to work and work and work. The extraordinary thing about the English is because, as I mentioned in a previous lecture, they used wind power, water power, animal power, and coal. Human beings didn't need to work so hard. It was reckoned in the 18th century that an average Englishman worked 1 day less a week than a Frenchman. They had a lot of spare time. It was also noticed by Frenchmen who came that whereas in France, after they had been working all day, they were so exhausted, they would go back to their house, and even then they would have to be working, preparing for the next day, mending machinery, getting the vegetables ready for cooking and so on. In England, he noticed in the evening, they just sat around. They went down to the pub. They played a game. They had a hobby. They chatted. They didn't work in the evenings. That was extraordinary. And they even had this most extraordinary invention, which has spread all over the world, even to, well, I imagine to China too, the weekend, what the French call le weekend, because the French didn't have it. In other words, taking one or two days off each week to do nothing. So the English invented the weekend because they had a lot of leisure. So the English in general, if you see from their material world, had built up a very substantial kind of buffer, that is, protection against the difficulties of this life in an agricultural society. And you can see this and the difference it made in looking at one crucial index. And that is when famine, when famine disappears. If you look at the last 1,000 years, so this is 1500, 1000, 2000. 1750, 1250. When you look at when the last major national famine, that is when millions of people died in terrible agony from not having enough food, a terrible condition which has gone through history in many civilizations. If you look at the last major national famine, between here and here, there has only been one in England, and that was around here, between 1215 and 19. There seems to have been some climatic disaster all over Europe at that time. Terrible rain, very cold, harvests no good, and at that time, a lot of people in England died of famine. Quite a lot, maybe 10% or maybe a little less. That's the last one. No more famines. There were little areas of England around here where there was a famine. Just on the borders with Scotland, there was a small famine. But no national famine in England after that. If you look at other civilizations. Every other civilization except the Dutch, which I'll leave on one side, continued to have famines until about here. This period around here is when famine disappears from the rest of Europe, Western Europe. Sweden and Scandinavia has famines until then. France and Scotland had famines till then. But by about 1800, famine has disappeared in Western Europe, except in Ireland, where you get the Great Potato Famine in 1851. Yeah. So first England, then a huge gap, then Scandinavia and the rest of Europe. Meanwhile, in the rest of the world, if this is 1900, the last great famines occurred very recently. For instance, the last great famine in Russia is Stalin's famines, 1930s. The last famines died out in India and China. India was still having famines in the middle of the 20th century up till the Bangladesh Assam famine in the 1970s. So India, China, the famines of the Great Leap Forward. Africa right up to about here. So most of the world only escaped from famines in the last 30, 40 years, the most. Europe, 150 years ago, England here, which is evidence of what I've been saying. Now, that's another part of the jigsaw, a very rich population created by that excellent agriculture which I mentioned in the last lecture. And also created by something else, and that is the population pattern. Usually, what we consider to be a modern population pattern or demography is one which you experience and which we experience in my country, which is that we hold down, I mean, as you know, a human being, a human female, if entering a sexual union, say at 16 or 17, and assuming that the children don't die off, will have on average about 15 live-born children. So the ability of humans to reproduce far beyond what is needed just to replace them is very great. And in the majority of societies, what has kept population in check is death. Almost all civilizations, there was no modern techniques of contraception. People entered sexual unions young, and as a result, what you got is two kinds of pattern. You either got a death rate which was very high, going along like this, and as a result, people needed to have lots of children to just keep the population level, so you have a very high fertility rate, which is number of children. That some populations have that. In cities, in much of the past, that's what happened. Many, many children died young, and you had a very high fertility. Another pattern, which is more like the pattern of most agricultural civilizations, like France traditionally, or China traditionally, is that in normal years, the death rate is not very high. It just goes along here, 20 per thousand or something like that. And then suddenly it shoots up and then goes down and then goes along and then shoots up. This is caused by the three disasters which Malthus talks about: war, famine, and disease. And so you get what is called a crisis pattern. It's going along okay, and then something. You get the Mongols, the Manchus, some epidemic diseases, a great famine in China. The studies of China, a famine in China, shows that there was almost every year in the last 2,000 years there has been a famine in some part of China. Often small ones, but sometimes great ones. So you've got this sort of level. This meant that if you looked at the population, the fertility was quite high, and the population therefore would do this. It would build up with a high fertility and not too many people dying, and then a disaster. You go along, disaster. And that is, if you look at graphs of the population of most agrarian civilizations, if you look at France, as I said, if you look at Egypt, if you look at many of them, it goes like that. It's very wasteful, and it means that people, again, have to try and have lots of children, because you never know when one of these disasters is going to occur. So you build up the population, and then it collapses. If you look at 19th century China, the Taiping, the Boxer, and the other disasters of China, you find these spikes like that. You find the same in many agrarian civilizations. So that is the, those are the traditional family patterns. And it was for quite a long time thought that this was universal. Every society before the 19th century and before the introduction of modern contraceptive techniques was like that. But in fact, there's been a lot of work, particularly in Cambridge, among the friends of mine, Tony Rigby, Lisa Laslett, Roger Schofield, and others, to show that the English have not had this pattern as far back as we can take the records, which is 400 or 500 years. Because what they've shown is that the English pattern was one where you had quite low mortality. Yeah, the traditional one is longer. This is quite low mortality and low fertility. That is to say, instead of having 6, 8, 10 surviving children, which you would have in many peasant societies, you would have 3 or 4 on average over the whole population, of which perhaps 1 or 2 would die. So it would balance out. On average, a couple would have just 2 surviving children, or a little over. Very low fertility and low mortality, which is much, much less wasteful. You're not bringing up lots of children who then die off, wasting your resources in that way and leading to the tragedy of lost children. How did they do this? Well, they did it in a very strange way. They didn't really have contraceptive techniques at that time. And they didn't use the technique which the Japanese tended to use, which was to control the numbers born after conception. In other words, by infanticide, by killing the baby as it is born. The infant is killed. Or through abortion. Aborting the fetus. Both those things are very widespread traditionally, historically in Japan, and to a certain extent in China. The English didn't use those techniques. They used, in many ways, a very rational kind of technique, which is they thought, we don't want lots of children. So how can we avoid this? And they avoided it by raising the age at which people got married. Now, in this society, because of Christianity and other things, you couldn't have sexual intercourse. You couldn't have children until you were married. And most people didn't. So if you, in India or most of the world, until recently, a girl would usually get married at between 14 and 18. So she would start having children at 16, and every 2 years she would have children. The average age of first marriage for women in England in the 16th, 17th centuries was 25. And since women usually on average end their childbearing at about between 35 and 40, this meant that you, and this later period is a little less fertile, this means that you, instead of having 20 years, and therefore you could have 10 children, you had maybe 10 years at the most and reduced fertility. So you might have 5 children at the most. This very late age at marriage was because there was a widespread view that you must not marry until you could afford it. You must have a home, you must have a job, you must have an income, and only then should you marry. You must put it off until you're ready. Because otherwise, you are going to head for poverty. You are going to be destitute. You are going to have no success in life. To take myself as an example, I didn't really realize this at the time, but when I was a boy, I said to myself, I will not get married until I'm 25. This was well before I knew of all this sort of historical research, but I sort of thought, well, 25 is a good age at which to marry. But I was quite keen to get married, so on my 25th birthday, I got married. I put it off as long as possible. But I had managed to just hold back and not get married. The other thing was that even so, even with this, as you see, people will have, say, 5 children. That's a little too many to reproduce if you're going to lose, say, 1 or 2 before they get to 25 through infant and child mortality. So the other thing the English did, in most societies like traditional China, Japan, India, France, and so on, particularly India, all women must marry, unless you're going in, if you're in Tibet and going into a nunnery or something, but and there are exceptions. But in big peasant societies, there is almost 100% marriage of women. It is a great disgrace not to marry off your daughters. It is the greatest obligation of a father, as I've discussed with my friends, who are even academics in India and so on. They say to me, Alan, you know, I must marry my daughters off, otherwise I would be deeply ashamed. So almost all women get married and have children. In many societies, you cannot, for instance, in some Islamic beliefs, a woman cannot become a true woman or go to heaven until she has married and had children. So it's essential. In England, you had this extraordinary situation, which explains a lot about English culture, that something like 1/4, that's there, 1/4 of English women at certain times, and other times 1/5, never married. They would remain unmarried women. They would look after other people's children, so get jobs as teachers or work in sewing and so on. You have this long tradition of unmarried women. And it is no disgrace not to marry. In my own case, 2 out of 3 of our daughters are unmarried, and you know, that's fine. Why marry? So the tradition of non-marrying women is very old in England. If you put those two things together, non-marriage and late-age marriage, you get a much slower rate of population growth. You get, in fact, a modern marriage system where people wait just out of interest. You don't have to answer this question, but how many of you are married? Can you put your hands up if you're not ashamed to say so? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Any more non-married? Do you see? Some of you were too ashamed to admit it, but on the whole, you're not married. If you were in a traditional peasant society, you would all be married, particularly the women. Long ago, you're in your 20s probably, you'd have been married for 10 years by now. So you live in a different world. And that world was first pioneered in this extraordinary English marriage system, whereby both men and women, and I will talk more about marriage patterns in a later lecture, but men and women would leave home, they'd go away, they'd get a job, they'd work for other people, and gradually save up. And for the 10 or 15 years between the time of sexual maturity, puberty, for 10 years or so, they would be gathering together. It'd be like a bird making a nest, or an animal gathering together the food to support their young. And then, one day, and this I'll talk about more, in an extraordinary way, they now have enough money, they have a good job, they're secure, and then they go off to what was the equivalent of a disco at that time. In other words, they'd go off to the village fair or dance, and they would see this beautiful maiden, or shall I put it in the female sense, she would see this handsome young man, and they fall in love. straight, extraordinary, crazy, as I'll explain, totally unknown in all these other societies, because in 99% of societies, you don't fall in love. Your parents decide, you are now 14, you should be married. So the women are married off. Not a matter of individual choice. It's not like buying a house or getting a car or something like that. It's just something that automatically happens early on in your life. Now, the effects of this is absolutely crucial for explaining the English Industrial Revolution and other things I've explored before, because what it meant was that English population was more or less level for a long time. Between about 1350, which is the Black Death in England, and 1750, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, that crucial 400 years when England needs to build up, remember the metaphor I gave you of a plane taking off, the energy to take off, it needs the wealth without which you could not have an Industrial Revolution. That takeoff occurs because if you look at economic growth in England over that period, it is growing like that, about 0.25% a year. Now, to the Chinese, that seems laughable, though rate you have 10% or whatever. But 0.25% a year over 400 years for a pre-modern society is amazing. It means that you double your wealth easily over that period. By just going like that. Meanwhile, the population doesn't do what Malthus thought it would do, which is to absorb all that extra wealth and just put it into more children. You're not worried about having lots of children. So you get wealthier. You spend it on better clothes, better food, better houses. You don't spend it on more children. And so the population goes along like that, roughly. Grows a little. And so the gap, the wealth gap, or the savings increases and increases. At this point, you begin to get the Industrial Revolution and the Urban Revolution, and you've got a mechanism whereby when you suddenly need lots of people working in factories, lots of people say, well, I can afford children because I'm getting good pay in a factory or whatever. And suddenly, the age of marriage drops by about 4 years. So you have one or two extra children. And the population, which has been pretty level for a long time, suddenly goes like that. Very fast for the first time in English history. But it's at a time when it can afford to do so. So just as individuals wait until they get married, until they can afford to. In a sense, the whole English population waited until it could afford start marrying younger, and larger proportions of women marry, and it did this. So, and then you find actually the same pattern in Japan, almost identical pattern in Japan, which I've written about elsewhere. So, you've got another part of the jigsaw.